Pushkin.
Hey there, it's Justin Richmond. Today we have a special Broken Record holiday episode with Nashville singer-songwriter Amanda Shires. We're going to start things off with an exclusive acoustic performance of her new song, Home to Me, from the album For Christmas.
You said there's ice on the runway, ice on the wings, ice everywhere, and nothing will bring you home to me, home to me, home to me. I don't want to talk, it's too cold to walk. I keep looking for you, but all I find is frost. You should come home to me, home to me, home to me. Please come home. And keeping my own company, I'm tired of the dark and a night full of brittle stars. You should come home to me, home to me, home to me.
That was Amanda Shires singing Home to Me. Shires' new holiday album For Christmas isn't meant to make you feel merry and bright. Instead, it's an acknowledgement of the complicated feelings that a lot of us have around the holidays, like disappointment, longing, and maybe even a little bit of lust. In addition to her solo career, Amanda Shires plays fiddle and sings in her husband Jason Isbell's band, The 400 Unit. She's also a founding member of the female country supergroup, The High Women, with Brandi Carlile. But way before she hit it big in Nashville with all of that, Shires played fiddle with the Texas Playboys, the legendary Western swing band started by Bob Wills that she joined when she was just 12 years old. On today's episode, Bruce Headlam talks to Amanda Shires about what inspired her to write a non-traditional Christmas album. Shires also explains how finding out that her grandfather served decades in Alcatraz raised a ton of questions about her family's history. And she recalls what happened the time she discovered Jason Isbell ripped off one of her lyrics.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Bruce Headlam with Amanda Shires.
First of all, Amanda Shires, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
People who know your music, which is moody and very evocative, might be surprised that you had a Christmas album out. I was surprised you had a Christmas album out. So tell me what the thinking was going into this.
I'm surprised I have a Christmas record out. Of all the things I never thought I would do was a Christmas record. But I think the catalyst for it all was just going into this year knowing that Christmas is going to probably resume to some sort of sense of normalcy as opposed to last year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I was really happy not hearing all the Christmas jams and going out shopping and all that, you know? That's not to say I didn't miss a lot of stuff about normal holidays. So that was what started it all. I was like, that might be a good song idea in there. And then I started writing one song, and then I wrote 10, and then I covered one.
Now, when you were growing up, I think most people had like a favorite holiday album. Did you have a holiday album at home that you were thinking of when you did this?
I really liked the Vince Guaraldi. I really liked that one in Burl Ives, you know. And my mom listened to a lot of like Pavarotti and what are those folks' names, those Irish folks that sing Christmas songs? And they're like operatic.
The Chieftains?
Yes, that! You did it! The Chieftains, yes! Because she's, you know, Irish and whatnot.
But she was Irish, your mom?
Well, we just found out, actually, that we don't know what we are because my granddad, turns out, was in Alcatraz and nobody knew it until after he died. So we don't really know where he was from in the end.
He was incarcerated in Alcatraz?
Yeah, for 25 years, one of the first 200. But when he got out, that's when he started a family with my grandmother. But nobody knew any of this stuff about Alcatraz and all this until our merchandise guy gave me a family tree, like a complete one, because his uncle is one of those genealogist types. And I was looking through it, and I was like, that can't be real. Is that real? And then we hired a private investigator, and turns out it's true.
That's amazing. Can you tell us what he was in for?
Yeah, he was a young man that was a career criminal. Car thieves, and you know how the money used to be in the post offices?
Yeah.
So he held up a post office and he took the postmaster's child and wife hostage, and nothing happened to them, but mm-hmm. except for obviously some kind of trauma. But yeah, when he got caught after that, he went to Alcatraz.
Did you know your grandfather?
When I was young, I did for a little while, and he passed away. He's quite old at that point, but yeah, I think that's gonna shed some light on a lot of different things in my life, probably.
Well, when you do your Christmas in Alcatraz album.
Exactly. So there's elements to that in my Christmas record, you know. People go to prison, you know. John Prine had a song, Christmas in Prison.
That's right, yeah. So you're gonna play some songs for us. So tell me first about Home to Me.
Home to Me captures a feeling of wishing folks were around that aren't, well, at Christmas time or any other time. And I think that that's feelings we all have around the holiday season and any season. It's kind of a desperate plea for reconciliation, I guess.
Was that your feeling last year with Christmas when you were isolated?
I feel that way about different people in it that come in and out of my life and then different family members, and I kind of wrote it in a way where I was trying to apply it to different types of relationships that I've had. But mostly it's like a love relationship when I think about it pretty hard. I just like to mask all my true feelings with, you know, other feelings. Feelings are complicated.
Because to me, I thought it was a romantic song.
Right, totally.
Or a song about a romantic relationship. But really, you were talking about something else?
I'm talking about that, but I don't want the folks that feel moved by the song and wish that it was their own father or somebody to feel waylaid in the outcome of finding out that it is like a love relationship. But I guess I should trust my audience.
It reminded me, this song, that holiday songs can be actually the saddest songs.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me the flip side of that old song, I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Right.
Which was a big wartime song. This seemed like from the other end, like come home.
It is that, for sure. I mean, I'll just start being honest about it. Who cares? It's like, you know, you want somebody in your life, and it's just not going right. And it sucks worse around Christmas.
Yeah, things suck worse around Christmas.
Yeah.
Let's go back a bit. You grew up in Texas, and you grew up, is it true you grew up near Mineral Wells?
I was born in Mineral Wells, population 14348. And my dad and my grandparents and stuff still live out there. And then when my dad and mom split up, I lived with my mom in Kansas City, and then Lubbock is where she finally settled down.
I don't know Texas very well. I've only been there a few times. Mm-hmm. I only knew Mineral Wells from the Tom Russell song. I didn't know it was a real place.
It's a real place. I have a song called Mineral Wells, too.
Okay, this is embarrassing, because I totally missed that.
Listen, I'm a little bit embarrassed that I tried to lie off my feelings on a Christmas song a minute ago, so we're even.
Well, we're going to get deeper into your feelings. Don't worry.
Oh, good.
Okay, I have to ask you, because a lot of people compare your voice to Dolly Parton's voice, and that's, of course, a compliment. When did you first meet Dolly Parton?
I met her at RCA Studio A for rehearsals for the Highwaymen Newport show.
And what was that like?
I mean, I asked her assistant the day before. I said, what do you think Dolly Parton would like me to wear? Because I really want to make a good impression. She said, probably leather and lace. And so I went home, and the next day I put on leather and lace, and sure enough, it worked. I waited. I got there early, and she came in, and we talked about our leather and lace a lot, and it was magical and terrifying. I mean, watching her work is an incredible thing.
We'll be right back with more from Amanda Shires after a quick break. We're back with Bruce Hedlum and Amanda Shires.
So was there music in your family growing up? Was there always music around the house?
There was music in my mom's house and in at my granddad's and dad's. They do wholesale greenhouse stuff where you grow plants and stuff for your nurseries. Mm-hmm. So there was music playing on the radio and stuff there. And then in the pecan orchards, it was just turn the tractor radio up as loud as you could get it. But my grandfather that I was very close to, Garland, he wasn't of the generation where I don't think they thought that playing music was going to get you anywhere. Because he had a guitar, but it was just in his closet.
And then but you started with violin? Was that your first?
Yeah, violin. I got that violin and I started playing in school. And then I met Frankie McCorder from the Texas Playboys and started learning by ear from him on his porch and was going to quit violin. And then my mom said, how about you do violin? And we could parallel that with the fiddle. And I said, that sounds like a sweet deal.
What was it like to sit on his porch and learn those old Texas Playboy songs? Because that's very high-end fiddling. That's a lot of jazz. All that Western swing stuff is really, it's pretty accomplished.
I was what they call ate up with it. It was my joy not just to hang out with them and listen to them talk and sing, but to learn. And then even go deeper. Like he learned from the first recorded fiddler, Eck Robertson, and learned songs that predate the Wills Band and stuff like that. I don't know if there's a lot of audio of them, but I've got tapes and CDs and stuff full of this stuff. And I don't know why. I've always been good at making friends with old folks, and I really prefer it because they're decisive and they're set in their ways and direct, you know? And so I do well in that situation. And then the music just spoke to me. So I did that. And, you know, instrumental music is the way I used to express myself back then because I didn't really have a vocabulary for expression as a 10 or 12-year-old with very little frontal lobe development.
Do you remember the first couple songs you learned?
The first Bob Wills song I ever learned was Spanish Two-Step. And that is the day I was told my mom I was going to quit playing the violin. She was like, we're going to just do both.
And then you joined the Texas Playboys for a while. How old were you?
12. I would go in and out in between school and when they needed me. You know, they didn't play a whole lot, but it was enough where I felt like a member of a band and we had scheduling and logistics and stuff. It wasn't like when you think of touring artists now, but a lot of that was they needed somebody to play that low third part, and I was willing to do it. And I don't think I really had an ego about any of the music or anything. I was just happy to be there. My stuff worked, and I showed up on time, and we all got along well. And eventually they started teaching me how to improvise, and that was a whole new bag of worms.
How did they teach you that?
In my mind, it's like throw your kid into the swimming pool. They'll eventually swim. They'd take their solos, you know, all night long, and they're like, at some point, we're going to point at you. You're going to do your solo. And I'm thinking, okay, well, this could go a lot of different ways, but they're my friends. They'll catch me if I fall. And I did. I fell, and I failed a whole lot, but they kept making me do it, not making me, giving me the chance to do it. Like, we'd play a song, like, Old Fashioned Love, you know, something easy, easy changes. Mm-hmm. And, all right, Amanda, it's your turn. And I'd have to go step up like I was taking a major solo. Then you learn really quickly that way, you know?
Were you listening to records as well of violin players to try and get ideas?
I didn't think about getting ideas from anything as far as improvisation until later, because I didn't know that that was a way to do it. But during that time, I was, in order to go to school, high school and junior high and all that, and be part of the kid culture I was in, I had to also maintain what was on the pop radio, rap radio, you know, the Tejano stations. But at home, it was strictly Bob Wills, Tiffany transcriptions. I listened to a lot of the individual Texas Playboys' fiddling records. And then my favorite was Louis Tierney, who played with them a lot. So I'd go listen to that song just to hear that part again. And I liked all of them.
Mm-hmm. And you're a very gritty violin player. It's sharp. You've got a lot of bite to when you're playing. Like, I compare you to somebody like Alison Krauss, who's a very famous fiddler, but she's got a much sweeter sound. You like that, really? Is that kind of a Texas sound, that harder sound?
I think that's a sound that I've kind of developed from listening to rock and roll and fighting with guitars. And it's also got a lot of what I have, which is attitude. I also think that you can do a lot with the texture of sound. Because sometimes I do think it's appropriate to make your violin whistle or go harmonic scrapey for whatever effect you're trying to achieve. And then depending on who's producing, those types of things can be, you know, affected in a way that changes a complete landscape of a song sometimes. Like in that song of Jason's, If We Were Vampires, there's some of that going on. And then Traveling Alone was kind of when I started playing with that idea.
Then when did the songwriting start? Because of the Playboys, you were on a bunch of albums. You were fiddling for a lot of people. You were sort of a side player. When did you start songwriting?
I started, you know, I wrote a little goofy poetry, but that would be after I sang for the first time a lead song. The first time I sang a lead on a song was I had to hold Leon Rausch of the Texas Playboys' hand to sing that song, That Sure Would Go Good. I have pictures and we're just holding hands. I was so scared. But then I started singing and then started doing harmony and trying to, you know, be available when somebody might want harmony or singing, you know, it just expands your work a little bit more, I guess. And I was playing fiddle, playing with everybody, singing, and I decided, you know what would supplement my income? I'm going to copy the Texas Playboys and I'm going to make a little fiddling record. And so I made a little fiddling record, not an artist record, just one to set up on the stage and get a couple of $10 or $15 here and there. Got about eight or nine fiddle tunes in, and I thought people might want to know, like, that I could sing in case they ever want me to sing with them too, you know? It's all very entrepreneurial in a way.
Were you touring in Texas at this time, or were you up in Nashville?
Texas still, because I did just basically all my pre-artist career was in Texas. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to sing a song so people know I can sing harmony and stuff, and I started thinking about what song I would sing. Then I realized you had to pay royalties. And and then I thought, well, self, what are we going to do? And so I made up two songs and I put them on there. Well, turns out that record was done and I found myself on the road with Billy Joe Shaver. And one night I decided, you know, there's enough room on that table. I'm going to set my CDs right there. That's what I'm going to do. And I set my CDs right there. I didn't ask anybody. Didn't know you had to ask. And after the show, he was signing some CDs and he said, is that your record sitting up there with mine? And I said, yep. And he said, guess we'll have to listen to that tomorrow, huh? And I said, oh, you don't have to listen to it. You could just have it and listen to it on your own time. He's like, nope, we're going to have to listen to it. And so we put it on in the car and then we're listening and there's nowhere, he's not saying anything. He's just got his radars for the cops, you know, driving real fast. And I'm worried. I'm like, whoa, what have I done? And he heard one of the songs on there and he said, you know what you need to do? You need to move to Nashville and become a songwriter. There's no loyalty in the side person world. And I thought I was being fired, like it was a polite way to fire me.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, No, Billy Joe, I love my job. I don't mind not selling the CDs if you don't want me to. I really love playing with you. I feel like I'm learning a lot. And he said, no, but you could be a songwriter. If you want to go be a songwriter, you should go be a songwriter. And I was like, I don't know, Billy Joe. I really like playing with you. And then a year later, I told Billy Joe Shaver I was moving to Nashville to pursue my dreams of being a waitress. And then I started over, and here we sit.
Was there a song you heard? Was there something that inspired you that made you think, I can do this? Like, who were your inspirations back then?
I always heard Billy Joe Shaver and thought, I wonder if I could do that one day. And just the way he captured exactly what he was feeling in that way. And then I realized that, no, I can't. I have to do the ones that come from me. But the other people I were listening to were everybody from Cyndi Walker, all of her songs from the Playboys. I loved that, like, that song, You Don't Know Me. And then of course, all of the Waylon Jennings and Dolly Parton I listened to. And I listened to acts like Jagged Edge and Destiny's Child and everything, Elliott Smith. And I started working at a record store, and it was just crazy. And then I fell in love with Leonard Cohen, and I was like, that's me. I'm Leonard Cohen. I don't mean I'm Leonard Cohen, but that's, I identify with that.
You went and got your MFA, which not a lot of country writers do.
Mm-hmm.
What made you want to do that?
My life philosophy is like, we're all here to learn, and, you know, as nature does, grow until we meet our end. So I went to get my MFA like I did when I was learning the fiddle, like with everything I had. When I discovered my passion for writing in words, I wanted to do that, and I wanted to know what I was doing, and I wanted to be able to make decisions and know the reasons for the decisions I was making and not kind of just go on instinct. Like, I wanted to know down to the preposition what the word choices could be and then how they would affect a line or an emotion depending on where and how you used them. And I just wanted to be kind of able to do it with purpose and intention and to not second guess myself, but also stay open to criticism should somebody notice something I forgot. But for me, I get passionate about something and I want to do it, and I want to do it right. And I don't get very passionate about a lot of things, basically just music, writing, and painting.
Where does that come from? Was someone in your family that way about what they did?
No, when I think about it historically, I think it's something that's been lost. Like, I don't know, I'm no historian, but I feel like people used to do a lot more things like read and be into arts and learning. And I'm not trying to sound like an old grandma, but, you know, there's a lot of TV watching going on when you could be exploring yourself and the world around you, you know. I always preferred being outside over being inside. Yeah, I mean, there's nobody else that I know that really, I mean, my mom was a single mother who eventually became a doctor, but that was also while she was raising two kids and being a bail bonds lady and working at Price Chopper.
Wow. Okay, I think we know where it comes from. That's pretty
good. Yeah, okay. All right, so there we go.
What was learning to write at an MFA like? What kind of things did you do, and how did they help your music?
I think the MFA was the hardest thing I've ever done. Like, I read everything James Joyce ever wrote. I suffered ocular migraines, and I lost vision in one of my eyes from reading so much, but it came back, thank God. You know, we'd do everything from workshops to study Middle English and Old English and, you know, where words came from and vowel shifts and poets. We'd study other poets and their works. And yeah, that was really fun, though. It was a lot.
Can you tell me a couple of examples in your songs where you could look at them and say, without that training, I wouldn't have written this song?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I wouldn't have written Parking Lot Pirouette without that training. And that's one of my favorite. Like, if I had to pick one of my favorite songs of my own, it'd be that one. Then White Feather from To the Sunset also. That's when all that was kind of wrapping up, and I wrote it separately. I have a record coming in the spring. None of the songs I would have written without this kind of training that I had, because they're going a little bit literary, I guess, but still accessible. And then with the Christmas record, I would say it'd be Slow Fallin' Snow and some of them would be a lot worse if I hadn't had the training is what it would be. It wouldn't be the same level of accuracy of words to feelings.
Now, I am going to put you in the spot because your husband had an online conversation with George Saunders, and I think people can find it on YouTube. So now, who do you want to do that with? What writers do you want to speak to?
Well, I will say that Jason did do that, but he was never asked by George to write a song for his 10th of December, and I was, and I did, and it was awesome. I would think Barbara Kingsolver.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to talk to her. I'd like to talk to Ada Limón, wonderful poet. And some of them I've already talked to. I mean, Tom Robbins would be fun. Definitely Larry David.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more from Amanda Shires. We're back with Amanda Shires singing her song, Always Christmas Around Here, from her new album, For Christmas.
It's quiet right now. The sky has gone dark. A sink full of dishes and laundry to start. A mess in the living room. There's wine all over the couch. My sisters aren't speaking. Who's crying now? It's always Christmas around here. It's always Christmas around here. Compounded interest, no sleeping in. Dad's asking for money. He's in a bad way again. Keep pushing down the trash to keep from taking it out. The bread always burns. Think we'd use a timer by now. It's always Christmas around here. It's always Christmas around here. It's always, always, always the same. It's always Christmas around here. Here at my house, lots of questionable tattoos, silent fights and holy fights, Dave's bass-ackward pews. We look forward to a new set of days, hoping for change. Maybe we'll win the lottery one day. And it's always Christmas around here. It's always Christmas around here.
This brings us around to, I think, just one of the most sharply observed songs on your album, which is Always Christmas Around Here. Can you tell me about that song?
You know how folks say every day's Christmas. Like, mm-hmm. When it comes down to it and you're sitting there thinking after, you know, everything's cleaned up and you're looking around just kind of noticing the conversations and enjoying the company with all of its positive and negatives. Just like in the moment, like it's just true. Because you get together this one time a year with folks that you don't see every day, and you're expected to hang out and agree on all things because you're related. And then you cook a turkey, like who cooks a turkey in the year outside of Christmas or Thanksgiving? Like, why are we going to have the thing we're the worst at making? That's a thing that always bothers me. You think about it and you're like, at Christmas, it's just, you drag all this stuff out and you decorate your house with it. But also at the same time, you're still doing the same things you do every day. Like every day, Jason and I are trying to see who's going to push the trash down the furthest or for the last time and who has to take it out. You know, that happens on Christmas. It's all just this, the way life just is all the time, but it just happens to be on Christmas. That's what that song is.
But it's full of sort of beautiful lines that just kind of sum up that experience. I don't remember the precise words, but there's wine stains on the carpet and mm-hmm. someone says, we'll win the lottery.
Yeah.
It's this incredible kind of slice of life.
I think that true experiences to me are the ways that you can describe the feelings the best in a song.
How do you go about writing lyrics then? Do you start with the melody and then add the lyrics?
Sometimes I'm like all of the writers. You could start with a melody and add lyrics, or maybe you start with a piece of an idea. I'm not one of those that writes to a title. I've never been able to figure that out. You know, a lot of people like write the title and they write to that. But throughout the year, I take lots of notes, and then the notes, I put little, like a couplet or a line or something on an index card, and I store them in my index card bins. And then when I feel like the well is full, I start taping them around my house. Like, you can't tell right now, but a lot of the walls are white, so all the index cards go up and the painter's tape goes up. And then I just kind of synthesize all that and pull out my little voice memo recorder to see what melodies I have. And then you start writing one or two, and then it just pours out of you.
Wow. So you tape them all over the house?
I used to only do it in the closet because I was afraid of judgment within my family. And then I realized that was silly. Then they started coming out of the little closet into the bathroom, into the master bedroom. And it only got tricky once when Jason ripped a line from me and I had to tell him that wasn't how this was going to work.
Did you just say, like, just tape up your own damn cards, Jason?
I said, I realize what's happened here, that, you know, it's impossible to not read the words that are on the wall, but it infiltrated your unconscious, and that's my line, and we have to be careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, I don't mind sharing, you know. I always tell them that I've got lines for days.
Are you one of those people for it just comes easily, that lines come?
I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a different type of person, but I think that I stay in a particular mindset so that way I can always find it, you know. I don't shut it down, that part. I write a little every day, and I still find beautiful lines and books and poems and room to get better. And I don't shut the part of my mind off that also shuts down imagination. So, like, I guess you could call it a little bit of your silly, like, self. You got to keep some kind of, like, part of you that's open and spontaneous and can find magic in, like, I don't know, looking at rocks.
That's interesting, because for so many people, you mentioned worrying about your family's judgment. That fear of judgment is what keeps them from being able to write. You don't feel that?
I used to feel that a whole lot, and I don't know if it's age and going to school and studying under Andrew Hudgens, but I don't feel that way because it's impossible to, based on some words, get a whole clear picture of what is in anybody's mind. Because, you know, truly, like, if any other songwriter took one of my little index cards words and it wasn't Jason, probably wouldn't even be very good.
Mm-hmm.
This is positive self-talk with Amanda Shires. This is how you do it. You be confident in yourself. You know what the hell you're doing. And then if anybody has questions, you can choose to answer them or not. And as far as judgment, that all kind of comes after the record's out. So you have time to fix it in between now and then.
How many drafts do you typically do of songs?
Lots.
Like a song on this album, how many would you have done?
I have 47 verses to Gone for Christmas.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. I have pages on pages of Always Christmas Around Here. Recently, my producer, Lawrence Rothman, is insisting that I don't shred them for 6 months, just so I could look at the process on my own better.
This is going to sound like a silly question, but a lot of people I ask this question to have very specific answers. Is there a kind of notebook you write in?
Yeah, I like a specific notebook, but I don't keep them. Like, I shred them. After I put the notes onto the cards and they go into my little index card bins, they all go in the shredder, and the shredded paper goes into the compost, and then I use it in my garden.
Why do you shred them?
Because the whole place would be a tinderbox.
Okay. This is just a storage issue. It's not you hate them. Or...
Well, and honestly, like, it's a little bit like that idea of if somebody saw my Google search history, they would really think something was wrong with me. But sometimes you have to know the details about, you know, turquoise mines, and then simultaneously you need to know the exact weight of a sash weight to use in a particular fight that some characters might have, and exactly what is strychnine and stuff like that.
Would strychnine just be after the Google search, my husband stole my lyrics?
Yes. Yes, definitely. After I Amazon ordered a knife sharpener.
Yeah.
Jokes. But there is that thing where, like, you have all these pieces of paper everywhere, and then they're left to interpretation, kind of like, I feel like it's shitty that they released Marilyn Monroe's diary, but I guess that's the risk you run if you leave your diary.
So you wrote 47 verses, and then do you try and put some together, or you just, like, you stroke off, like, you get rid of 44 of them, or I can't remember how many verses are in the song.
Some people say way too many, and some people say not enough. The way I do it is I try some out in the studio. Like, I bring my favorite, like, with that one, I brought my favorite 20 in, mm-hmm. and then I tried some out, and then as you go and you follow the thing that makes it the most fits the best. And then the other ones could be another version if they wanted to be,
mm-hmm.
if, you know, they decide to be for Christmas number two.
So you are Leonard Cohen, because that's how he wrote. He wrote hundreds of verses for songs.
Well, I don't always do that, because Home to Me, I just wrote that in one go.
Tell me about the last song you're doing for us, which is A Real Tree.
This one's a funny song. I always like the idea of things that happen around the holidays, you know, like new love interests or, I think we know what I'm talking about here. It's instead of a fake tree, this lady's found herself a real tree. And I guess it's a euphemism. Christmas is a time for romance and booty calls and sadness and nostalgia and all the things, right? Like, it'd be like, just trying to, like, that's the point of the record. You can listen to a lot of Christmas records, and it's either hymns, which are great, or everything's really happy and snowing.
Right. And this is all the rest of that stuff. That's what's so great about this album.
This is all the rest of the stuff you're forgetting about. Yeah. You're forgetting about the part where you could find love or divorce.
Should I check in with you again after Christmas just to make sure you're...
I mean, why not? Might as well.
Okay, I just want to know which way it goes this year.
Right.
Let's dress you up to be seen. I've been looking forward to this for 52 weeks. I got feathers, gold, and silver beads, garland and up to cover all six glorious feet of you. I got a real tree this year. It smells like menthols and Old Spice. A real tree this year. Took my fake one to the roadside. Tonight, I'm putting you in bows. A red velvet skirt, I'm dripping you. Take my time and pour some wine. Get the lights on, your limbs just right. I'll flock the hell out of you. I got a real tree this year. Smells like menthols and Old Spice. A real tree this year. Took my fake one to the roadside. I haven't decided if you'll wear the crown or the big bright star. Oh, how you shine for me through the dark. Your reflection in the window, you beautiful thing. I'll take what I want, my candy cane from my real Christmas tree. I got a real tree. Catch myself staring a real
It's been just delightful talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Amanda Shires for singing some songs from her new holiday album, For Christmas. You can hear it and check out a playlist of our favorite Amanda Shires songs at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. We'll also post a holiday playlist curated by our Broken Record team. You can follow us on Twitter, at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lavelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.